Archie McPherson is one of the best-known faces and voices in the history of Scottish sports broadcasting.
It's the end swing. That's a beautiful goal!
His amazing career has seen him cover the world of sport, travelling across continents to report and commentate on World Cups.
Good play by Gemmell. Great play by Gemmell. Can he do it? He's done it! Oh, a great goal!
European Football Championships.
The Scottish supporters are going mad!
European Cup Finals.
They've got a European trophy.
Olympic Games.
A very good morning to you from sunny downtown Los Angeles.
And so much more.
I got a surprise call from a man called Danny Boyle.
Now he talks to me, Tom English, about his adventures in journalism. In this episode of This Sporting Life, Archie recalls his earliest World Cup memories and his experiences at the 1974 and 1978 tournaments in Germany and Argentina.
The World Cups were all different from 74 to 98. They all had a different characteristic, different personalities, different managers, different players, different issues and so on. But there was one common thread that ran through everything, and that was the simple word, coping. How can you cope with taking a legion of men living together cheek by jowl, not just with themselves, but with journalists, with the intense scrutiny that they were going under? How can you cope? And how can you, if you like, insulate yourself from all these matters which have nothing to do with picking the right team for the right game to beat the opposition, but just how to live together, how to sustain the pressure? That period, Tom, between 1974 and 98, I described as the golden age for Scotland's international team or international football, largely because they qualified, as distinct from the other areas when we didn't qualify. So on that account, it seemed to me innovating and special for us. And not only that, it was because a record in the World Cups prior to that had been, I mean, the comedy unit in the BBC would have written better about what happened to Scotland in the World Cups. And even in 1950, I remember as a schoolboy, standing in the enclosure, the southeast enclosure at Hampden Park, Scotland against England. And for some reason, which I have never been able, even in all my research, to work out, the Scottish SFA at that time had decided that they would go to Rio, which was by invitation, by the way, the World Cup at that time. They would go only if they avoided defeat by England in that game at Hampden Park.
In soccer's record book, this Hampden Park International will go down as Scotland 0, England 1. And that won't tell even half the story. For to Billy Wright and George Young and the teams they lead, it's more than an international. It's a cup tie, with Rio and the World Cup a glittering prize. Dark-shirted Scotland, attacking the goal to your left, have to avoid defeat if they're to make the trip.
Lovely sunny day, and we all went with great enthusiasm. England are leading 1-0.
And now England are away, led by Bobby Langton. Dashing up the wing, he squares the ball to Bentley. Roy races on, and wham! It's in!
And Willie Bald of Hearts, who was a famous player, took a ball chest high and smashed it against the underside of the crossbar, and it didn't go over the line. We lost 1-0. Rio was forgotten entirely.
To England, the glamour of victory, and with it, the international championship. To Scotland, attacking to the last, the glory of going down fighting.
And I remember being crushed and humiliated. It was then I began to doubt the existence of God himself. How could they do this to us? So we never got to Rio. And then in 1954, of course, our manager, Andy Beattie, he gave up halfway through the tournament. And we had no manager for the second part of the tournament. And then poor old Matt Busby, because of the Munich disaster, he couldn't manage in 58. We had no manager at all. So this was the sense of humiliation was overwhelming. And then when Joe Jordan, the kind of toothless Joe Jordan, got his head to a ball against Czechoslovakia and scored that goal, which put us into the World Cup for the first time in 16 years, it was like nirvana.
So much pressure on the Czech goal. This is Morgan. There goes Jordan, and it's there. The substitute has scored, and surely now...
I did feel like a young boy again. You're greatly excited, and you're entering a new era almost. And so off we went to Germany.
74, that was your first World Cup to
first
cover
World Cup.
As a journalist.
First World Cup as a journalist. And that's a very good point you make, because we were naive. Hmm. We were innocents abroad.
Well, in the past couple of months or so, we've been talking intensely about the World Cup in terms of football only. But when you get to Abbotsinchia and watch the Scottish team depart for the continent, remember they're going to Belgium tomorrow, and they'll be playing in Oslo on the Thursday night before they reach Germany next Friday. You begin to imagine it's more like an expeditionary force than a football team at all. They're carrying a vast array of luggage, including over a dozen huge hampers with 30 football strips and tracksuits and football boots, etc. And they even have a full physiotherapy unit, including an ultrasonic unit for any special injuries they may get in this preparatory week. They look in tremendous spirits. And indeed, if you look at the spirit and the luggage, you can see that they're prepared for a long stay in Germany.
I have to say, that very first flight from Glasgow to Brussels, which was an inaugural flight from BEA turning to British Airways, and it's important to remember that point because they were celebrating. So as we walked on the plane, we were handed a bottle of champagne each, not to share, each. Players, press.
That would have been gone by takeoff.
Before we hit the first nimbocumulus crowd, it was away. So we were right into that. And of course, the players were involved in that as well. I have to tell you, Tom, that flight and what developed from that flight actually overshadowed Scottish international football for subsequent World Cups because of reputation.
Yeah.
Because what happened was we played the first game, the first friendly game, against Belgium in Bruges. Scotland were terrible because some of the players had been imbibing. Now, I say this and stressing the point of naivety. How do you prepare for a World Cup? Well, we're all celebrating like weekenders going to Blackpool for the lights.
As players and journalists.
Players and journalists.
No distinction between the two in terms of the boozing.
No distinction whatsoever. We were all into it gleefully and innocently. And we were also put up in a Doss House kind of place at an interjunction for every lorry travelling in Europe, and we couldn't sleep, nor could the players sleep. The players were hungover when they played Belgium. Terrible thing to say, but they were hungover because of all of that.
And this was what? This was as a kind of pre-World Cup
Pre-World Cup, yes.
Right, so this is very close to the start of the
very
tournament.
Close to the start. And then we had to go to play in Norway, and it wasn't all that much better, although Kenny Dalglish began to show his form at that game, scored a goal. And then, the night before we left, we had an occasion which I think began to spread the word about the behaviour of the Scottish players. Because John Motson, the BBC commentator, who was very new at the game at that stage, John and I were sitting in this wonderful students' lounge. So we were sitting there, and all of a sudden we heard singing breaking out. And then came Jimmy Johnson and Billy Bremner, the Scotland captain. Uncle Foo, as the bard would say. Innocent, harmless, but noisy, and singing at the top of their voice. Now, John Motson, who was brought up in the liberal arts tradition of English education, looked in horror at these two crude, drunken Scots. I mean, you can't describe them anything other than that. Wandering towards him, he says, "What we do? What we do?" And I thought the worst thing to do is rise up from advancing Scots and give them the cold shoulder. You're in trouble. So I said, "No, just sit tight." Willie Ormond, the Scotland team manager, then suddenly appeared away in the distance and saw them, turned on his heel and did nothing and went away. The Celtic doctor was also the SFA doctor, who suddenly came about 10 minutes later to come in, and he literally grabbed them by the scruff of the neck and hauled them out. Now, there was a great to-do about that, and by the following morning, the press were discussing, should they be sent home? There was real division in the press, the Scottish media at that
time. And Archie, what was it like then, Archie, in terms of inter-journalist rivalry?
There was an edge. Yes, there certainly was an edge. There was one journalist, John McKenzie, who was banned from the Scotland flight from Norway to Germany because of what he wrote. The other editors of other papers were saying to their journalists, why aren't you banned as well? What have you done not to be banned? They were letting this side down. They should have been banned as well. That's how keen the competition was. And yes, they tried to outdo one another, obviously by having private deals with players, with the manager. For example, the BBC wanted an exclusive with Willie Orman. So up came the top executive to Glasgow, invited him to lunch. We sat down for lunch together, and suddenly I felt a fumbling at my knee coming from the BBC producer. I reached down with my hand, and it was a brown envelope. So I secreted this under the table to Willie Orman, as if he was signed, sealed, and delivered.
And you knew nothing
BBC
about this little arrangement?
No, I knew absolutely nothing at all about it. That was supposed to upstage ITV.
Yeah.
And Sam Leach, the very famous presenter, told us, remember, it's like the war. When you go into the bar with a drink with them, keep your lips sealed. Do not tell them what the BBC are doing.
In terms of the players, Bremner, who's a guy who fascinates me, and all the other players, and all of that rancour and bitterness towards the press, and maybe vice versa, did that carry on?
Yes, absolutely it carried on. Yeah. That rift became a kind of internal condition. They had to be very suspicious, and of course, it heightened in 1978 for reasons that I'm sure we'll talk about, with a lot of unfairness attached to it as well. Because other players in other countries were misbehaving as well. I mean, it got so bad, Tom, that reports were being put out by the foreign press that the Scottish players were taking booze with them in their team hamper for training sessions. I mean, the thing was getting ludicrous, but it was their own fault.
Yeah.
Although, again, I go back to my initial statement, we were all innocent. We didn't quite know how to prepare for a World Cup.
Was the boozing, particularly from Bremner as team captain, was that seen as a kind of an act of rebellion against Ormond's management?
And not so much against Ormond. Let's face it, Tom, some of these Scottish players would have a drink at any excuse at all, so maybe it wasn't a rebel with a cause. But they had fallen out with the press and they had fallen out with the SFA. They had fallen out so badly with the SFA that in the morning they arrived, they took their breakfast knives and started to rip the Adidas strips off their boots because they had fallen out with the sponsors as well. It was outright rebellion. And the word was seeping out. And what we had forgotten, of course, we were going into an area where it wasn't just the local press any longer, it was the world's press. And it was so bad that we begin to worry about the morale of the Scottish players heading for the greatest tournament of their lives. And that worried us because the news reports were really awful and the players began to shun everybody. It was a dreadful scene.
Did it have its origins in the Jimmy Johnston boat thing?
Yes.
There was serious animosity between you guys in the media and these players.
Absolutely. After they had beaten England 2-0 at Hampden in the last game before they went to the World Cup, the players together looked up at the press box and gave very demonstrative V signs to the press. And that set the scene for animosity from that moment on. So think of this. We're going to the World Cup for the first time in 16 years, and then all of this happens. Hugh Taylor of the Daily Record summed it up with a wonderful title in one of his articles. He says, "The Tour de Farce." That demonstrated to us we could be in big trouble. However, we went on our way to Germany, having the SFA decided that they wouldn't send them home. And I'll tell you what, it came down to a split vote. And I think it was Willie Allen, the very staid SFA secretary, who maybe cast the deciding vote. They went to Germany.
They went to Germany. But you had all this stuff going on. You had the Jimmy Johnston thing.
Jimmy Johnston, I loved him. A lovely man all the way through his career. But he was sucked into so much trouble. He couldn't avoid, and he was fond of a drink. And that was his major problem. But he was utterly harmless. Now, the Scots, preparing for the England game before the World Cup, stayed in this little hotel, the Queen's Hotel in Largs. It was a small hotel. It wasn't good enough for a big squad. But they went there. They went there traditionally. They were penned in. So it was understandable that they wanted to get out of that place and get breathe some air while they were drinking as well. So they went down to the shore and they got into the boats there. The boats are always handy for the tourists and so on. And he started to row, and Jimmy went on his own and lost an oar, and the boat began to drift, and calamity ensued. Now, you can't do that when the press are sniffing around. They were onto it like a flash. Even before the England game, the banner headlines about Johnson in a rowing boat and so on. That relationship between the press and the media, the erosion of that, really started with that rowing boat incident at Largs. And its aroma floated all the way through to Germany and the World Cup. It does pain me to say these things, Tom. The World Cup shouldn't have been a glorious festival. But here we were with these troubles before we even kicked a ball. We got to Germany and stayed in a lovely skiing lodge in the Harz Mountains. And at that time, of course, the IRA had threatened reprisals against some of the players. So there was intense security. You couldn't move, but there was a German policeman round beside you. Any time we travelled, we had a helicopter over the bus and mounted police all along the line. It was quite astonishing. And the first game, of course, was against Zaire. Now, I was fortunate, and I had as my co-commentator Jock Steen. And I remember the first game against Zaire, when we got to a commentary position, it was intensely hot and humid in Dortmund. And it was clear the Germans were supporting the young African team playing for the first time at the World Cup. We won 2-0. But I remember at halftime, Jock Steen said to me, you know, these players are suffering out there. There's no question the atmosphere is affecting them. They were playing against a team who had never played in the World Cup before and who were running around like young kids in a playground. But eventually we went on to win 2-0.
Must be very, very hot down there. Jordan. And it's a goal! Oh, it almost took the net away. Peter Lorimer hitting it first time. The goalkeeper, Kazadi, no chance at all. The Leeds United player looking absolutely delighted. Still there, and surely a free kick. Bremner just holding himself back there. And Jordan's there, and it's a goal! Everybody stood still, and Jordan has scored the second one for Scotland. Everybody stood still, the Zaire defenders, and he just waltzed in and took it. Jordan popping up from almost nowhere, and the goalkeeper, in fact, may have thought it was offside.
The night before the game, we talked along with David Coleman. David Coleman, who was a brilliant commentator, but always regarded by the people who worked around him as a dictatorial ogre, but nevertheless a brilliant commentator. Yeah. And we were talking about the team selection. And Jock said to me, you know, I know what they'll do. They'll play Dennis Law. And Dennis Law is not up to it any longer. And they did play Dennis Law, who's into his 30s. He was the oldest member of the team. And he was there because he was an icon, because people respected him, because he inspired the players simply by being there. But against Zaire, he just didn't show. And we knew that would be his last ever game for Scotland. And so it was. In the second game of the World Cup, we had arrived in Frankfurt to play that game against Brazil. We, at that stage, were luxuring in the full attendance of BBC Network because England were not there. But let me illustrate this difficulty that arose. Because I was told before the Brazil game, there's no room for BBC Scotland to do
the Scotland World Cup game.
Brazil, yeah. you can't get in.
You would not have taken that on the chin.
You cannot get in. And so I heard that and I was dejected. So I lifted the phone and phoned a political friend of mine, Norman Buchan, Member of Parliament. I knew he and his wife, Jeannie, very well. I was a supporter of his. No, and in casual conversation, I said to him, oh, by the way, I'm not doing the Brazil Cup. Why not? I said, well, I've been told there's no room. Oh, is that so? Now, I don't know what Norman did for me or whatever the hell, but I suddenly ended up. And when I got there, Tom, there were multifarious empty commentary positions. So I've no idea whether David Coleman, as I told you, had a huge ego, had been an influence in all of that. But nevertheless, I did the commentary and that was that. The day before the game, we were wandering around, Jock Steen, myself, and his friend Tony Queen, the bookmaker, and we sat down in this hotel. We knew the Scottish team were staying there. So in walks Billy Bremer with another player. I can't remember. Because of what happened, I can't even remember who was with Billy Bremer. And he sat down beside us and he started to moan. Yeah. And that was the biggest mistake he made in front of Steen. He started to pour out his sorrows to Steen. Steen reached across with his big coal miner's paw and put it under his chin. He really threatened him with violence. He said, look, get into the press, stuff the press, show them out in the park what you can do. Well, I have to say, looking back on that, Scotland needed a figure of inspiration. And it came from that moment on from Billy Bremner. He was immense. His performance against Brazil, the no-scoring draw, was superb. Unfortunately for him, anybody who looks back in that game remembers the miss at the near post when a ball came skidding across them and his legs didn't function. Yeah. When it looked to some people, but not to his players, as if all he needed to do was shove a leg out and it was a goal.
Here's Joe Jordan, and a keeper says, no, what a miss. Oh, Billy Bremner. There's not much he really could do about that. He was running in on it. It was so near.
Throughout, he was absolutely inspiring. Behind him, beside him, David Hay. I have to say, there are two performances that Scotland had against Brazil that were outstanding. First of all, in 1966, when we drew one each with them in a pre-World Cup game before they went to London, where Stevie Chalmers scored the winning goal.
C1 continues with an extra programme. Recorded highlights of last night's football match between Scotland and Brazil played at Hampden Park, Glasgow.
And it's Brazil then, kicking off in this international game here at Hampden Park tonight with a pretty full house against Scotland. Scotland in the dark blue jerseys with the white shorts. Brazil with a yellowy coloured jersey with a pied of blue, and this may be the first one. And that's the first goal. A magnificent effort there in less than about 30 seconds. And the scorer, the centre forward, Chalmers. And this is exactly, of course, what Scotland wanted to really set the game up further. Oh, and it's the equaliser. My goodness me, how he squeezed that in up against the post, only Sevilla will know. The score then is Scotland 1, Brazil 1.
Jim Baxter was so good that the great Pele himself said after the game in an interview, I wish he was a Brazilian. That was brilliant. The second best performance was that no-scoring draw. Scotland should have won that game. Coming off the park, the Scots players thought they had really turned the tables on what had happened to them, that they had redeemed themselves. Well, they had to a certain extent, but they still had to play that third game against Yugoslavia. And I remember before that Yugoslavian game, Billy Connolly came up to the Scottish camp and everybody relaxed. There's this sensation of here's a Scot who's now becoming famous in another area. And he lightened the whole atmosphere. So we went very optimistically towards the final game. At that stage, people began to wonder about qualification and began to worry about a 2-0 victory against Zaire. It wasn't enough. So we played against a team that had a really solid reputation, Yugoslavia, in the Waldstadion, when Brazil were playing in the other game against Zaire. The one feature of it I do remember in particular is me worrying about why not bring on Jimmy Johnson. Now, he was out of favour. Socially and professionally, he was out of favour because of the incidents that happened previously. And because, and this is the interesting thing for me, Jock Steen never supported him. He never made any complaints to Willie Orman.
Because Jock is working for the BBC.
He was
you're hearing what he's saying, but also you're hearing what he's not saying in public.
Exactly.
Behind the scenes, you're getting it all.
He was not supporting Jimmy Johnson at all. And in fact, Jimmy Johnson left Celtic only a couple of months later. And Jock Steen refused to play him in the very last game he could have played for Celtic, which shows you how unsentimental Jock Steen could be. So that game was, I really think, imprinted on my mind was the goal, the Yugoslavia goal.
Well, this is number 18 going through, and Jai flying dangerously here. Danny McGrain. There's a good one, it's a goal! Number 18, Taraci, has scored for Yugoslavia, and that effectively puts us out of the World Cup. Such a simple chance, with about 8 minutes of the game left.
Now, Danny McGrain told me many years later, actually, that he blames himself for the goal. Playing against the player he was against, he thought he didn't have a left foot. So any time he went for him, he tried to edge the man away from his right foot and play to his left. And lo and behold, he turned the ball to his left foot and swept over this immaculate cross, which was headed in by a Yugoslavian player. He blames himself to this day, of course. He shouldn't. Joe Jordan scored towards the end.
Good run by Hutchison. And it's there, it's a goal! It's a goal by Joe Jordan. But I think it's come too late. With only a minute to go, Scotland have equalised. And oh, if only that had come 15 minutes ago.
But that was it, or was it? Because we knew in the other game that Brazil, I think at that stage, were only two up. And we were still going through. Some of the players went into the dressing room thinking, we might just have made it. Then Brazil scored with about 10 minutes to go against a 5'6" Zairean goalkeeper who was impossibly picked to play in that game.
What are you alleging here, Archie? Are you suggesting something untoward?
I don't know. Anyway, it was so disappointing. Arthur Montford, my great friend and colleague and rival on the other channel, I remember speaking to him. He was in the commentary position beside me. He didn't reply. He was numbed. As if a dagger had...
That Scotland were out?
Scotland were out.
Yeah.
A dagger had pierced his heart.
There wasn't much to celebrate, but the Scottish fans made the best of it in Frankfurt last night. Scotland were out of the cup, but they'd scored goals and they hadn't been beaten.
Well, up here in the Taunus Hills, there is a bit of a morning after feel about the Scottish camp. The team have had a Sunday lie-in, but now they're setting about the business of packing up, ready to go home tomorrow. I asked Willie Ormond whether he was disappointed about his team's showing in the World Cup.
Not in the team's performance, no. I'm disappointed that we're out of the World Cup. I thought the performance of the boys were fantastic. Brazil and Yugoslavia are very, very difficult teams to beat. And I was very proud of the way the boys went about their job. They played first-class football. We went forward. We didn't try to play defensive stuff at all. I didn't think we got just awards for it. I mean, you lose one goal, you don't get beat, and you're out of the tournament.
So we were out of the World Cup and we came back to Glasgow to a multitude that turned out at the airport.
How do you feel about the turnout today, Willie?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic.
So they come back as heroes. You do remember thinking, hang on a second, this doesn't look great. Celebrating, I would say failure, but not success.
Not success. And as I saw this seething mass of people rejoicing at a team who had come back undefeated, I have to say, from the World Cup. The only team in the tournament that actually had achieved that. There was something of the seed of fantasy that overtook us in the following World Cup in 1978 about our own worth.
Did you think in 74 Scottish football fans saw it as a triumph?
They did. They had been reading the reports of the disasters in the pre-World Cup tour about indiscipline, about drinking. We achieved our first win ever in the World Cup against Zaire. A very good result against Brazil, and then sheer disappointment. But looking back, becoming undefeated in that sense, it looked as if we had promise for the future. And I think we began to, that good conceit of ourselves began to take over, and it certainly affected us in 1978.
And I know it's a big leap on to 78, or at this point 77, because that trip to South America in 77, which took in Chile, Argentina and Brazil, was it?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Massive controversy. And when you look back at what happening in Chile, Pinochet had come in, a bloody coup, outrageous atrocities, and yet Scotland go and play a football match there.
Yes, I remember the BBC came to me and said, we would understand if you decide not to go. Because I think they knew where I stood politically, of the left. On the other hand, I wanted to go and see what it was like.
Yeah.
I wanted to experience
That's a journalist in you. You were inquisitive.
Exactly. I was inquisitive. And off we went in this very, very long flight, landing in Buenos Aires. And I remember as we went into Buenos Aires, the police were out in front of us. It was accompanied by an armoured car because the Montoneros were the guerrilla movement at that time. They were blowing things up against the dictatorial regime.
Yeah,
I remember an old man trying to wander across the street as the bus went down. There was the police car in front. And I remember a police hand reaching out and punching him out of the way. An old feeble man with a walking stick. This was Argentina before we actually got into Chile.
Yeah.
When we got to Chile, lovely hotel. I remember we're sitting by the poolside, the whole Scottish team. And up came this very suave gentleman speaking impeccable English, who started to talk to the players, and we could hear them. They were promoting Chile. They were saying, this is a democratic country. He was obviously sent up.
Yeah.
You'll enjoy yourself here. The people are free. And it went on. And Kenny Dalglish simply, Kenny could make a point. He told them to,
To go.
Get off.
Yes. Yeah.
And he knew all about it. And the guy was shocked to the core. And then up came this small guy, Scottish accent, and he said to me, because he recognised me from television, he said, would you like to come down and have lunch with us? We are worker priests in the Catholic Church. We're working with the poor in the poblaciones, as they call them. And I said, yes, well, of course we'll come down. And when we went down, he showed me the bullet holes that were on the wall, and it gave me an idea of, here we are getting ready for a football match in this totalitarian country where the poor people can hardly put a scrap of bread together. Should we be feeling guilty about it? Well, guilty in the sense that, yes, what can we do about it? There's nothing we can do about it. But not guilty in the sense that it's opening our eyes to what's going on here.
You went for lunch with the Scottish priest. Did he educate you?
Yes, he did. He talked about the extent of poverty.
Yeah.
How difficult it was for children to grow up without rickets. And I'm hearing all this before, you know, we play a football match. It showed you the devotion. And when I say it was a lunch, it was bread and cheese lunch. You know, it was a very, very simple lunch. And I know you might say to me, well, going all that way with these poor people suffering like that, and you call it educational. Well, yes, it was. And so to the actual game itself. It was played in this misty stadium, Chile Stadium. What we didn't realise at the time, but this is the stadium which had been turned into a concentration camp. In the dressing room itself, you could see pock marks, which must have been bullets as well. It was a dismal, dismal experience, and it was a kind of misty, foggy night. Scotland changed the goalkeeper, and I didn't realise that until the end of the game. You know, I did a whole second-half commentary with a different goalkeeper there. So it gave you this distinctively uneasy feeling, trying to separate sport from other things that happen in life is extremely difficult. And that was the extreme example of it.
That's an extreme example. And it's the stadium, and there was I think I read somewhere there was up to 7,000 people held there at one point.
Yes.
Murders there. There was women were sexually assaulted there.
Yeah.
Can you remember what did the SFA say at the time to justify going there so soon after all that was going on, 3 years later?
The World Football Authority, we've heard it before and we've heard it since, organisations saying that's nothing to do with us. I mean, we're going to be playing a World Cup in Qatar, which is a horrible human rights record. And FIFA is saying, no, it's where the World Cup is going to be played. And we were just simply glad to get out of there.
Yeah. The following year, World Cup 78. Am I right in saying that going into the World Cup in 78, the sense of euphoria got so high that if somebody like yourself had kind of not talked down the team, but it said Scotland mightn't win the World Cup, that you were kind of shouted down. You're almost like, almost accused of being negative and anti-Scotland.
Rationality disappeared. And we were led by a lovely man, a guy who wouldn't do you a bad turn. If we'd had a durer figure leading us into Argentina, it may have been different. But we had a guy who was a professional optimist. The right words at the right time to infuse us with this feeling that nobody could beat us. I mean, when he, in his first press conference, he tapped the side of his nose, his large nose, and said, "Concorde has landed. And I'm a winner, not a loser." We took that as a cue that this man, if not exactly Moses leading us out of the wilderness, but certainly not surely the Pied Piper leading us into the river, but we gave him the benefit of the doubt, hugely gave him the benefit of the doubt because of his charm and his success. That particular night in Liverpool, when Scotland qualified for the World Cup, was quite amazing.
Jordan's there. Field, surely a handball penalty kick. It's a penalty kick to Scotland. A handball, if ever there was one. The referee perfectly correct. Up goes the hand and the punch, if ever there was one. A penalty kick.
I, as a commentator, said, unequivocally, it was a penalty. Although there is apparently some doubt about it, that Joe Jordan might have been involved somewhere along the line. But I stuck to my gun.
The Welsh are very unhappy about it. The fist was there. Don Masson to take this penalty. Masson to take it. And he's done it! He has done it, and the Scottish supporters are going mad.
Well, what do you think now? Watched it all these years later, many, many times.
It's not about what you think now.
Yeah, I suppose.
It's what you thought at the time. I hang on to what you thought at the time. But in any case, the goal at the end, the Thunderers goal at the end.
And it goes to Dalglish. Lou McCarry supporting. There's an overlap. Martin Buchan. Good running by Buchan, read it well. There's Kenny Dalglish in there. Oh, what a goal! Oh, yes! That does it!
And I remember when he went in, Jock Steen grabbed me like a Scottish supporter, like a Scottish fan.
Jock!
Kenny Dalglish goes right in behind the Martin Buchan cross. puts it well away.
The hero of Liverpool has done it for Scotland.
But I also know that it was a sense of relief. The Scottish support at Anfield that night, and in Liverpool, because thousands didn't get in,
yeah,
were in a pretty volatile mood.
Were they?
And Steen said to me before the game, I hope to God we win, because they don't look all that particularly docile.
Mm.
So it was a sense of relief that we did, and we had qualified, of course.
And perhaps, Jock, it's as well for Scotland they got a goal like that. The penalty might have been a bit something to talk about.
It doesn't really matter. They've qualified, and that's the main thing. Doesn't matter how the goals come. They should have got goals early in the match. Took them a long time to get them, but there it is now. They're well on their way now.
And we had built up for it, though, by beating England at Wembley. You remember the famous crossbar breaking?
Yes.
And the turf being horticulturally removed by the Scottish supporters. And this overwhelming feeling that, yes, we're going to get somewhere. I remember being on the platform doing my commentary, surrounded by tutting English, who were rather offended by the pitch being affected and their crossbar being broken. Hooligans. Well, there was a touch of hooliganism about it, of course.
The final whistle's gone. And onto the field come Scottish supporters. Made of English oak, or else the crossbar's going to go. Looks to me as if the net is going back to Glasgow with a few pieces of wood, and some lawns are going to be re-turfed. One hopes you don't give. Oh, the crossbar's gone. And that is Wembley conquered by Scotland.
When Ali McLeod, there's footage of him saying there's a little space on his cupboard in his house. This is at the time, 77, 78. Then they say, oh, I'm keeping that space because that's where the World Cup is
going
to go.
Yes.
I honestly think that Scotland, provided that we play to a reasonable form at all, we will qualify. And I think a medal of some sort will come, and I pray and hope that it's the gold one. Space is in the wardrobe for it to be put there. And it'd be disappointing for the lads if they didn't make it, because without a doubt, they're the best squad that's left the British Isles yet.
Do you think it was all tongue-in-cheek, or do you think he actually felt that Scotland would win the World Cup, or was he just a showman?
I have great ambivalence about that. Mm. He was a showman. He was essentially a showman. And I think about 75% of that was showmanship, with the feeling underneath that with a decent set of players, and he had a decent set of players, there's no question about that he might just make it.
Yeah.
Now, I had the privilege of touring the country with him. He met the public. I went all over Scotland with him at different hotels.
What year was that?
That was the run-up to the World Cup itself.
Was it?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with him, driving with him and so on. He told me amazing stories. We would come across such adulation as I had never experienced before. They were standing on the table. And I thought to myself, Ali, if you fail, you're going to make Icarus look like a swallow. You've got to win this, son. But we all went along. I went along with it.
Yeah.
I remember saying to him once, I brought up the age of one or two of the players. I said, is it possible that Don Masson, Bruce Rea might be, you know, past the best? I tried to mollify as well as I could. The crowd went violent. And Ali egged him on. You hear what the press say? I wasn't Archie any longer. I was the press. And that's when I said to myself, you'd better win, son. I remember the BBC offered him, BBC London offered him to go with me to go and watch Argentina play Peru in Peru. A wonderful opportunity for him to see them in the flesh. We went out, he didn't go.
Yes, in fact, famously he didn't go.
In fact, the Peruvian press called me El Espion, the spy. They thought I had come to spy on Peru. Our first opponents were Peru, of course. And to my knowledge, he never ever saw them in the flesh, either Peru or Argentina. And Jock Steen, I know his name keeps popping up, yep. but it's unavoidable.
Yep.
Jock Steen learned from that. That's why he went to New Zealand.
Yes.
To cover his backside.
Yeah.
To make sure that he didn't make the mistake that Ali made of not having gone and actually watched these opponents.
That first game against Peru. And obviously it was a nightmare for Scotland. But it wasn't exactly a pleasurable experience for you in the broadcasting sense.
No.
Tell me about that.
That night in Liverpool, I felt I was going to have one of the most enjoyable experiences of my life by commentating on a World Cup game from the other side of the world. Somebody in BBC had not booked the line. So I was told. So my wife turns on, listening to me do the commentary on Scotland, Peru, hears David Coleman and thinks the Montañeros have captured me.
Dalglish. Good play. Hartford on for number six. Rioch and his favourite left foot. There's Jordan. And it's 1-0.
I just sat there angered. I tried to do a commentary. You know, I actually tried to do a commentary, knowing it wasn't going any damn where, just to do it. To say to myself, I'm done. Here I am in this country. And, oh, dear, it was so awful. And I remember walking the streets of Cordoba that night, trying to come to terms with myself, having missed that. And anguished at what happened on the field of play.
On top of the tangle, and it's 1-8. Scotland then hesitated, and Cueto took full advantage. Rioch. And a penalty given to Scotland. Doug Matson now has had to wait about 2 minutes to take the penalty. And he saved it! A brilliant save again by Haroga. The goalkeeper's save Peru. Kubiás with space for the shot. Oh. He put that away so well. Peru go ahead 2-1. Peruvians very useful in these dead ball positions. Mignanti dummy. The ball slipped through and it's a goal. And Peru take this 3-1 lead.
I felt so dejected. That linked to the airport scene coming right from Germany, from the adulation that followed, from the expectations with Ali's showmanship. I felt maybe this was the end for him, even at that stage.
One game in.
He could not recover from this.
The Iran game's next, 1-1. You were broadcasting. They managed to plug you in this time, did they?
They did, and I have to say the Iran 1-1 draw is the worst performance I ever saw from a Scotland team. Now, I've seen Scotland teams beaten before and played not badly, beaten and played poorly. This was like our culture had been taken apart. Here we are, the nation of wee Tanner ball players, skillful inside forward players. You know, that was our tradition. And again, on a very, very hot day, they were stronger than us. We simply could not find any coherence whatsoever. And we just went down the drain. It was painful to watch.
Again, the Iranians drifting back. Here's a Hartford. Jordan trying to go in for that. Oh, there's a hand. There's a hand, and it's a goal. It's a goal, and everybody's stunned. Ball drifted in there, and there was a touch and pushed forward there by, I think, Eskandarian. Scotland one up. Pressure still on. Oh, that's it. It's a goal. It's the equaliser.
I was beginning to think, could this get any worse?
It kind of could, really, in a sense, depending on where you look at it. Was there a press conference after that, the 1-1 against Iran? Was this bizarre scene of a dog coming into his press conference?
The Scotland team had been housed in this hotel, which the Adams family wouldn't have considered to live in. Gordon McQueen made the famous remark about the swimming pool which never opened and the soup which couldn't be eaten. And he said, well, could you not fill it with the damn soup and we could all of us swim? We don't want to eat the soup. It was that bad. Anyway, out he came for the interview. I'll long remember it. And before he even spoke, this mangy dog came up and started to rub against his leg. And he reached down and patted him and said, ah, at least I've got one friend here. Because he knew what was coming.
It was like, I'm laughing, but actually quite sad.
Listen, when I look back on Ali, and some of the things I've said about him are cruel. There's no question at all about that. But I saw the disintegration of a man then, and that was not funny in the slightest. Yeah. Where I saw he really came out of character was that night we were all invited back to this hotel in the center of Cordoba to a reception run by the SFA. And that was when the news about Willie Johnson's taking of fencamphamine, it was dreadful. The news was broken.
After the news that Johnson was to be sent home, the squad had somehow to pick up their spirits. They had to try to forget their 3-1 defeat by Peru. They had to try to get over the fact that one of their players had been sent home in disgrace for taking drugs.
When did you first hear about this allegation?
This afternoon. It's the first time I've heard of it.
Were any drugs or stimulants taken at all? Because I understand you were suffering from hay fever or something of the sort.
Very heavy cold. I don't know what's about. Never took anything like that in my life.
The upper drug, which all footballers, virtually all footballers, took anyway, because a lot of fencamphamine went down the plug hole by other players, but he was found out.
Must have been mayhem.
Well, it was mayhem, but the pictures of Ali in the dugout, he looks like a condemned man. Yeah. Head in hands. And you feel damn sorry for him. There's no question at all about that. You could see that Ali was disintegrating.
The venom of the reaction, from press, but certainly from the public, do you think that was born out of them feeling stupid for believing in this in the first place? And they took it out on Ali McLeod.
Absolutely. There were some people who suddenly realised, wait a minute, what have I been writing? What have I been talking about? It was hypocrisy at its worst.
Did the win against the Netherlands help?
It was a curious way of helping. And we were playing in perhaps one of the most beautiful stadiums I've ever been in. Because it was in this little bowl in the foothills of the Andes. The Andes were towering above you. It was spectacular.
Johnny Rep. And a good recovery, he's given a penalty kick. Renton Brink really misses from this spot. And he does it, 1-0 to Holland. There's Joe John going for this, touches it inside, the police must score, yes! A classical move, diagonal pass, touchback, and Dalglish does it this set. It's a great chance, it feels for a penalty, and it is. Penalty kick. Graham Souness brought down Archie Gemmell to take this. It means so much to Scotland. He really must put it away. And he does. 2-1.
There was something changed about the Scottish team. They had fielded Kenny Dalglish and, for the first time, Graham Souness. Yeah. Which made an enormous difference.
Yeah.
And then came the famous goal, of course.
Good play by Gemmell, great play by Gemmell, can he do it? He's done it! Oh, a great goal!
Believe you me, it's the first time I ever saw commentators acting as if they were a chorus line in a production. Because when Archie Gemmell picked up this ball, just about 25 yards from goal, looking harmless at that stage, and then went forward, beat one player, nutmed the great Rude Kroll, and then with a little swift, pushed the ball in the back of the net. It was like a narrative, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we all rose. You could see commentators rose. Is he going to do it? Is he going to do it? He's done it.
Oh, superb! 3-1. This is a superb goal. One of the goals of the tournament, surely. He goes through, looks as if he'd lost possession, kept his head, a narrow angle, and look at it.
The sad thing is, of course, again, it was goal difference.
Yeah.
Because Johnny Rep hit the shot, which actually was glanced slightly, as I learned from Alan Ruff in later years, off the side of Archie Gemmell's boot, which Ruffy tells me deceived him in goal, of course. And in it went, and down we were.
There's Rep going in, and he hits space there. He might let Rep. When he does, it is a brilliant goal.
out just by goal difference again. Jock Steen, his name pops up again, said to me, after listening to our commentary, he said, the commentary was unusual because the pair of you started out as if you were at a birthday party. Then it was like you were at an Easter House wedding. Then you were at a funeral. He said it went up, 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 and then down, down, down. And I said, well, you can understand it because of the circumstances of the game and the issues involved in the game. We came back to a man who sadly was reviled by people. I mean, people shunned, you know, he got a terrible time after that. It was an absolute disgrace.
Yeah, when I came back from Argentina, everyone, well, all the newspapers and that were over there led me to believe I was going to be executed when I come back, you know. I knew I wasn't going to be knighted, but, you know.
He tried, within the parameters of his own personality, he tried his best for us.
He did.
Often lay in my bed and thought about, what would I do if I had to do it again? You know, I think I would just have done it the exact same way. But it would have been marvellous just to have succeeded.
I don't think he ever felt that he had let anybody down. I think he just felt it was part of a managerial job that simply didn't work. And to that extent, I feel immensely sorry for him.
Such great insights from Archie McPherson, and there are more to come. Next time, Archie tells us about his continuing travels across the globe, including the World Cups in the 1980s in Spain and Mexico, through to Scotland's appearance at France 1998 on This Sporting Life.